Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We all know people who are irrational, right? It seems that in everybody's life, there are those who simply won't accept fact, who cling to beliefs that couldn't possibly be accurate even in the face of seemingly irrefutable evidence. Despite all the progress we have made over hundreds of years of empirical study, science in the 21st century is sometimes treated like an article of faith, something we get to choose to believe in or reject. If you do embrace science, it's easy to feel a little smug when you compare yourself with those who can't come to terms with concepts like evolution or climate change or the widespread benefits of vaccines. But as my guest today will tell us, whether we accept or reject scientific conclusions, our positions on science are often as influenced by peer pressure as by logic. Joel Achenbach writes about science and politics as a staff writer for The Washington Post. His article, The Age of Disbelief, Why So Many Reasonable People Doubt Science, appears in the March issue of National Geographic magazine. Joel, welcome back to Think.
Great. Thanks for having me.
One of the big challenges as science gets more complex is that many of its conclusions strike us as counterintuitive. And you open the piece talking about resistance in Portland, Oregon to fluoridating water, based more than anything on a sense that putting chemicals in the water just somehow must be bad.
Well, chemicals, just the word chemicals. If you hold a sign saying, don't put chemicals in our pure drinking water, let's face it, we don't intuitively like the idea of putting chemicals in water that we drink. Now, the scientific consensus on this is that it's a good idea. The reason that it's done almost everywhere in the U.S., there are some cities that don't, and Portland, I think, is the largest one that doesn't, is that fluoride in small quantities helps prevent tooth decay, and it's a way of getting it to everyone. I mean, whether you're rich or poor, whether you're a good brusher, toothbrusher or not, it helps. It seems to help the public in a broad way. But there are people who don't like the idea, and there are campaigns against it for different reasons. It's not just the belief that it will harm you, but I think there's some people think the government shouldn't be involved with that, just as a rule for ideological reasons. So this story that I did for National Geographic is something that we worked on for a long time. There's lots of different issues we looked at, and we didn't try to litigate each of these issues. For example, climate change. Obviously, we talk about climate change. It's a really important issue. But what we're looking at is, well, why do people develop views in opposition to what the scientific mainstream view is? So, you know, what's the dynamic there of the polarization? Is it happening more now? What's driving this? And there's a bunch of issues where you see it. You see it with the vaccines and the big controversy about whether vaccines might have a link to autism, which is there's no evidence that that's true, but a lot of people strongly believe that. Pardon me for carrying on, but there's other issues too. Genetically modified organisms or GM food, should you label that? Do you need to label that if you buy it at your supermarket, those kind of foods? Is that stuff safe or not? There's a lot of scientific issues, and you see in this day and age passionate, vitriolic, rancorous debates break out over what does the science really say.
And certainly the times we live in make it very easy for people to find alternative information sources. So if the sort of prevailing consensus is that, you know, GMOs are safe or vaccines are safe or climate change is happening, there's a lot out there that you can find that will tell you, no, all of that is wrong. Believe us.
Absolutely. You know, I don't want to blame the internet for everything because it seems like it's just too easy to do that. You know, the internet is, you know, hurting the newspaper business. I'm a newspaper reporter and so on. But it's also a wonderful thing for the news business too. But the internet does help organize people in opposition to something or in favor of something. It's a great way of bringing people together. The problem is that people can easily become part of what a scholar this morning on another radio show referred to closed information loops, which is what I'd call an echo chamber. You get into your echo chamber, and everything you hear affirms what you already believe, and you're not exposed to alternative views. Another term you hear sometimes is the filter bubble. If I go on Google and type in a phrase, climate change, Google kind of already knows what I think and what I've been searching for previously and will give me different results than another searcher will get. And I can be fed into a kind of a bubble of information that already is what I'm kind of looking for, and this leads to confirmation bias. You never get exposed to the other side of the argument.
I suppose, we can all be sitting here thinking this is true of someone else I know. And it's probably worth asking about the extent to which all of us engage in confirmation bias without necessarily meaning to do it.
Well, of course we do. It's human nature. You in theory, if you want to be purely scientific, you would never start with a conclusion or a belief. You would start you'd sort through the data, and you'd come to a tentative hypothesis, and then you would test it. You'd try to falsify it or expose it to the possibility of being falsified. And science is very good at creeping toward the truth by using this kind of method in which you start with a conjecture. You don't start with a conclusion. But human beings, naturally, we start with the conclusion. We have our beliefs. And, of course, we tend to be susceptible to confirmation bias. The other thing that I get into in this article in the National Geographic is that some things that science tells us are not just counterintuitive, they seem to be in contradiction to what we directly perceive. So the most obvious example might be that it looks like the sun goes around the earth. I mean, you can see it. It rises up in the east. At least it does here in Washington. I don't know about in Dallas, but and then it sets in the west, and it's clearly going around the Earth. Except we know that's not true. In fact, the Earth is spinning, but you can't feel the Earth spinning. And when Galileo started embracing this Copernican model in the early 17th century, it was hugely controversial, in part because of all of the implications that it had for kind of disrupting the whole nature of the geocentric universe. So science also asks us to discount our direct experiences of the world. Let's say there's something I feel a cold coming on, and in my family, for some reason, we have a belief that if you eat a certain kind of a fruit, that'll make the cold go away. And you do it, and it seems to work. But then some science study says, no, sorry, peaches will not get rid of a cold, and we've studied it. And so what are you supposed to believe? What you perceived yourself or what you heard about or read about some science study? Of course, we tend to overemphasize our direct experience. The other mistake we commonly make is we confuse correlation with causation. Something happens, and then later something else happens, and we assume the second thing was caused by the first, when in fact they could be random events or just a statistical fluke. And it's hard to overcome these naive intuitions, which is what science asks us to do. And so we do our best to figure that out. But none of us, comes into the world with a perfectly scientific mind.
You make the point here that it's important to think about how we define science. Can you talk about the difference between looking at science as a collection of facts versus looking at science as a strategy for understanding the world?
So science is not just a stack of facts that are known. In fact, almost all science as it's conducted is conducted at the edge of the known, or else it wouldn't really be science. If let's find out something that we're unsure about. Let's probe into the frontier of knowledge. That's where science takes place. Of course, there are things that are a fact. I mean, the Earth is not flat. The Earth is round, or almost round. And I think it bulges a little bit in the middle. But there are certain things that, sure, they're facts. But in most of these hotly contested issues, what you tend to have is you tend to have a kind of alternate universe or ecosystem of alleged scientific fact that contradicts the mainstream view. So, for example, on vaccines, there's a lot of research to suggest that they're safe and that this alleged link with autism has been debunked. Nonetheless, you could, by searching around the internet, find material that would look at a first glance like it was supporting the view of a link. And so, where does that come from? You know, what's the origin of these alternative theories? You have to in this day and age be very, very vigilant in figuring out where does this information come from? Is this a credible source?
And one story that we hear that is moving or frightening tends to stick in our minds a lot better than all of the unwritten millions of stories about kids who did not get the measles.
Yeah, of course. The isolated case, and we're all asked to do risk analysis. I make this point in the article. We are asked to do risk analysis of stuff that is very hard to do. It's not very intuitive. So, for example, something like, is it safe to consume genetically modified food? And when I say genetically modified, I don't mean through traditional breeding, which has been going on for thousands of years, but from laboratory techniques. Is it safe to consume that? Now, the scientific consensus is there's no evidence that it will hurt you or that there's any difference between corn is the big thing that's been genetically modified. There's no difference between that corn that has a laboratory technique behind it and corn that comes to us from traditional breeding techniques. That said, we don't intuitively know it's safe. When my grandmother was living on the farm in Indiana, she never had to worry about things like genetically modified food from coming out of a laboratory because it didn't exist yet. She didn't have to worry about, are cell phone towers safe or is electromagnetism going to hurt us? They didn't exist then. So many of the things in our world today are new technologies that we're asked to do risk analysis of, and you know, is this safe or not? And it's hard to know just from direct experience. So we have to turn to the experts and say, well, what's the best evidence here? What should I believe?
And scientists who are being honest and ethical can very rarely say, I can absolutely 100% guarantee to you that this thing that I'm asserting is true and will remain so.
Yeah, good scientists tend to tell you right up front that there is an element of uncertainty in what they do. If there was no uncertainty in what they were doing, it probably wouldn't be very interesting science. I mean, there's always an error bar. So with a lot of these issues, someone might say, well, you can't be 100% sure that the Earth is going to warm between, 2 and 4 degrees Celsius. But science doesn't deal in absolutes. It deals in probabilities and likelihoods. And you have to go, what's the best available evidence? And then let's build a policy or a public awareness based on the best approximation of what's true.
My guest is author Joel Achenbach. His piece in the March issue of National Geographic magazine is called The Age of Disbelief. We'll be back in 2 minutes, and you can join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. SMU Summer Youth has hands-on workshops in robotics, Minecraft, game design, and visual arts for students entering K-12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration opens March 3rd at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Washington Post science and politics writer Joel Achenbach. He has an article in National Geographic magazine in March called The Age of Disbelief: Why Do So Many Reasonable People Doubt Science? You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. It seems to me, Joel, there's also an issue of, like, human-scale observations. Like, you mentioned earlier that we can't feel the rotation of the Earth. We can't tell that generating a lot of CO2 or methane has anything to do with, say, the average temperature of the Earth. And, of course, we struggle to see the logic, that word in air quotes, in how a couple of degrees difference in that average temperature could possibly throw the entire climate out of balance.
I think on that issue, we should be clear that the driving force behind all the controversy is not sort of a lack of intuitive understanding on that issue. I think that's one where there's an active campaign of either disinformation or an effort to say, well, this is all a hoax. I mean, you have powerful people in Congress who say, well, all the scientists are lying about this. And since my article came out, I've gotten a lot of emails from people who are angry about that particular issue. They often say, hey, I believe in science. I'm scientifically minded. But on climate change, this is all a big scam and a lie. And, you know, it's borderline a conspiracy theory. You know, it's very unlikely that you'd have thousands and thousands of scientists colluding on something to pull the wool over everyone's eyes about climate change. I'm not sure what the incentive would be to do that, particularly given that scientists actually like to be contrarian and say, no, I have a new theory that shows the previous theory to be wrong. They don't tend to line up, you know, together with a story that's not true. I don't know of a case of that. And I think but what you have there is you have a lot of ideologically driven media, such as conservative talk radio, saying, well, this is all a scam. You can't believe what you read in the newspaper on this or what you might hear on the radio about this on other radio stations. And because it's all part of some plot to attack your values, and you know, maybe there's a so you've read this, you've heard this, and we've all heard it, and so that's a case where it's become this issue of climate change has gotten subsumed into the culture wars. It's gotten swallowed by it, and it didn't used to be the case. Yes, there's always been some controversy, a lot of controversy about climate change. But in the 1990s, it was not so neatly polarized along ideological lines. And well into this century, you could have people who would, for example, seek office as Republicans who would say that they accepted the scientific consensus on climate change. Mitt Romney said that, for example, in 2008. John McCain even campaigned in 2007, circa 2007, 2008, campaigned saying we've got to do something about global warming. And it was after that that the issue became so fraught with political division and kind of a badge of, well, what tribe are you in? Are you with us or are you against us? And that kind of thinking is not helpful on any of these issues. You know, whose side are you on? I mean, we get this is not just climate change. You get it on issues like GMOs. You get it on vaccines. You know, are you with us or are you against us? And once you get into that dynamic, forget about it. You know, it's just going to become, you know, a spitball contest.
One of the researchers that you feature in the piece, Marcia McNutt, points out that there is no clear downside to ignoring science.
Well, certainly on some issues like climate change, it's more of a long-term problem than it's a very, very immediate problem. Some people might disagree on the immediacy issue, but it would be convenient if there was no issue there. It would be nice to just wave it away and to go on about our business and not put some kind of price on the carbon pollution that we put into the atmosphere. I'm not suggesting that a policy here, because I don't know what the right policy is, and I think there's legitimate debate about what we should do. I think there's no question that there's different options, and some of them are it might be better ideas than others. But what's happened with the climate issue is that the premise has often been attacked, initially with people saying, no, the globe is not getting warmer. There's no proof that it's getting warmer. And then that argument went away when the satellite data came in much more robustly, and people I don't think many people say that global warming isn't happening at all. But, you know, people attack the underlying science, saying, no, it's all just natural. It has nothing to do with human beings. And that's not helpful to have a debate about the underlying causes. If you deny that humans are a factor at all in global warming, then you're stuck at square one. It's hard to know what to do about how we burn fossil fuels, for example. So, you know, that obviously is, I'm sure your listeners out there, someone will want to call in and chime in on this issue. I think we need to find what's the general consensus on the most likely plausible evidence of what is happening, and build policies around the best evidence, even if we can't be 100% certain.
It's interesting that even if we want to use science as a tool to measure and understand, you know, the natural world, these big brains we have that allow us to do science tend to fight us along the way as we make conclusions.
Sure, you actually have to repress some of your naive intuitions about things. Science teaches us stuff about evolution, for example, that we're all descended from a common microbial ancestor. That's people have done, you know, academic scientific tests, and it's easier to believe that we're descended from a primate than that we're descended from an ocean dwelling microbe a long time ago. You have to labor to believe some of that stuff. And you know, I think we're all blessed to have science and technology at our disposal as these great tools for not only understanding the world, but actually creating a world that ideally will be not only more comfortable, but it'll help feed people. It'll save people from terrible diseases. It has already greatly increased lifespans and cut down on infant mortality. And so many ways that science and technology and medicine have improved the world. At the same time, we have to figure out, make sure that the consequences, the side effects, the unintended consequences don't put us into a long-term jam, which I think a lot of people are worried about. And as we go forward, you know, I say this at the end of my article, I think we have to be smarter. I think we have to, and not just on climate change, but sort of on how we design and engineer our society so that it's one, so that we make a world that we want to live in, that's just, that's beautiful, that has room in it for human relationships and art and love and all these other things. And it's not just a scientific and an engineering question. We have to bring the humanities into this conversation, and religious leaders and spiritual advisors, to figure out, well, what should the world be like 50 years from now, 100 years from now? We can't just leave it up to, you know, Silicon Valley to decide, well, this is the kind of gadget you ought to have.
One thing I really loved about this piece, Joel, was that going along reading it, I was sort of patting myself on the back and thinking, well, I'm one of these people who, you know, trusts scientists, believes that most of them are trying to do the right thing and that they are trying to get to the answers. But it's not necessarily that I am any more logical or learned than the average person. It's that my peers, my sort of tribe, as you describe it, feel quite similarly. And that might have as much effect on how I come down on these issues as anything else.
Sure. I mean, so this is the theory of cultural cognition that's advanced prominently by Dan Kahan of Yale University, which is that even those of us who believe – in evolution, for example, believe in evolution for the same reasons that people who reject evolution reject it. And it has to do with our cultural identity and the tribe that we belong to. I think that his work has been very influential and is very insightful. I would note as a caveat that evolution is true.
Right.
So I mean, I've spent years as a science reporter talking to biologists and ecologists, and if you don't have evolution, then the biological world doesn't make any sense. It's kind of a cornerstone. So I don't really consider it to be purely a badge of who I am and the cultural as a cultural marker. But I think it is true that one thing that we all need to do is is be not just open-minded, but to listen to each other and try to build trust and within our society, so that we resist this notion of that there's a big conspiracy out there to lie to us. The people in the world of science, in particular, need to work on the trust issue. That means they can't come off as, ivory tower elites who don't care about ordinary people, because they do care about ordinary people. We're all in this together. And I know we're not going to have a big kumbaya moment and a big group hug, but I would love it if the volume got turned down a little bit on some of these debates, and some of the people, for example, who've been writing me emails, if they understood that they don't need to move to uppercase in their emails to shout at me. I can read it either way, so and I'm sure you've had that experience too. Occasionally.
Did you anticipate this vehement a reaction to this piece?
The whole thing is controversial. It's like a one-stop shopping for all your controversy needs. Pick a topic. I mean, we threw a lot of stuff in there, and I think I did anticipate that it would roil the waters a little bit. I would say, by and large, I've been really pleased with the reaction. The piece just came out a couple weeks ago, and it's the March cover of National Geographic, and it's also ran in the Washington Post, my newspaper where I work. A slightly shorter version ran in the Post, and by and large, the reaction has been overwhelmingly positive. And even some of the people who are unhappy with some element of it, by and large, have been very civil about it, and they want to have a discussion about the points of contention. So I'm sort of exaggerating when I talk about people yelling at me. Most people have been very civil about it, because I think it's, even though there are some demagogues out there who will say, beware the mainstream media, they're lying to you about this stuff. But most people, I think, know that's not the case, and that they can tell from my article that I'm just trying to get it right like everyone else. What is going on here? Why are we having debates about everything? Why is this the age of contested knowledge, where pick any topic and there is a furious debate about it? Now, in some cases, it's a little silly, like, the Loch Ness Monster or Bigfoot, or, are there aliens in Area 51? I mean, that's always been around. But on so many other issues, including ones that involve really personal matters of like health and nutrition, there are debates, and it's hard to figure out what to believe. I mean, you just go to the grocery store and look at all the different nutritional supplements. Do those things work? What should you put in your – what should you swallow, literally and metaphorically? Because you see this stuff that's sold at the Whole Foods that it says that this claim has not been adjudicated by the FDA. Is it true? Does that stuff really make you smarter or less sleepy or whatever? So I think we have to sort through a lot of difficult questions in this modern world that we live in.
And of course, again, for people who don't do science for a living, sometimes the fact that scientists really improve their credibility by changing their positions when new evidence comes to light causes some people to think they have waffled or they can't be trusted. And I'm thinking even recently about these new recommendations about dietary fat and cholesterol. This flies in the face of what we've been told by the experts in science for decades. And so it's hard for people, you know, to sort of quickly jump on board with the new information, even if many scientists have done so.
So the great killer app in science is the ability to change your mind. So if you're a scientist and new information comes along, you can say, I have changed my mind on this, that the new results give us a different conclusion. And of course, the problem is someone will say, well, why should we ever believe you? And that's kind of nihilistic. You know, science doesn't deal with absolute truths. It deals with provisional conclusions. That's what it does. That's how it works. And in this case, I have to admit, pretty shocked to hear that eggs are okay. I mean, I didn't see that one coming. But it is and there are other examples, actually. I mean, the big issue right now if you were to go around biomedical researchers, the big issue is the lack of reproducibility in a lot of these experiments. So one team will do an experiment. They report a result. Another team tries to replicate the experiment, and they can't do it. They can't get the same result. So is the first one not true, or did the second team just not do it quite right? This is a big issue in science right now. They call it the irreproducibility issue. But it doesn't mean that science is all a bunch of hooey or that you shouldn't believe in anything or be nihilistic about it. It just means that we don't have a complete understanding of the natural world yet. We're getting there. We're edging our way forward.
Journalist Joel Achenbach is my guest. He reports regularly for The Washington Post and has the cover story in the March issue of National Geographic magazine called The Age of Disbelief: Why Do So Many Reasonable People Doubt Science? We will take your calls after the break. The number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. SMU Summer Youth has hands-on workshops in robotics, Minecraft, game design, and visual arts for students entering K-12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration opens March 3rd at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is science journalist Joel Achenbach of The Washington Post. We're talking about his National Geographic March cover story, The Age of Disbelief. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find Henry in the colony. Hi, Henry.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And forgive me if you touched on this a bit earlier, but I wanted to see if you would speak about the either a cognitive bias or maybe a logical fallacy for people to tend to stick to their beliefs despite new information, you know, because of hubris or, you know, they feel a personal affront. And sometimes it takes to a logical conclusion, like it's kind of how doomsday cults works, where, you know, they all put all their eggs in one basket. The world's going to end tomorrow. It doesn't end. So you'd expect all those people to just quit, but instead it sometimes strengthens their resolve. And so,
sure. Henry, thanks for that. It's an interesting point. There's some famous research done about some of these end-of-the-world cults. The name is eluding me of the group. It was like in the 1950s. The world was supposed to come to an end. I think a spaceship was going to come take them away, and it didn't show up. And rather than everyone deciding, well, we were wrong and that this prophecy was bogus, I think that they just came up with an alternative interpretation for why it didn't happen. In general, people don't tend to change their mind due to new information. In other words, they don't if you gave them a big stack of books to read or assigned them a whole bunch of articles to read or sent them a bunch of links in an email saying, read all this stuff, surely you'll see that I'm right and that you're wrong. That isn't what changes people's minds. What changes people's minds is if someone they trust, who they believe is an honest broker, says it's okay to go there with your belief system, that you can believe this and not be feel alienated from your culture, your tribe, your traditional values. So, for example, it's a big deal when the Pope and says it's okay to believe in evolution, that this is what science tells us. And it gives people an understanding that believing in evolution doesn't mean that you're not a good Christian. So I think that the way forward has to do with trust building more than just lobbing more information at people. The research shows that that doesn't work.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Austin in Dallas. Hi, Austin.
Hi, Chris. Love the show. Love this subject.
Thank you. I have a
question. Do you think that when, say, atheists portray science as like their Bible, they are portraying science as a religion and then opposing other religions with their religion? Do you think that does? Do you see that? Do you think that does? Maybe you know what I'm trying to get at there.
Sure. Austin, thanks for bringing that up. I mean, there is a word you sometimes hear, which is scientistic. And this is there are certain people who've occasionally been accused. Carl Sagan was accused occasionally of being scientistic, of thinking that that only science could give you an answer about the world, that the only truth came via science, and that you couldn't get truth via art or some other experience, revelation, meditation, et cetera. And I think that there are some people who might drift towards being scientistic, but by and large, the nature of science is kind of, and I'm a newspaper reporter, I'm not a scientist, but scientists tend not to have rigid, orthodox beliefs about the knowledge that science is creating, because they know how it comes about. It actually comes about through experimentation and observation, falsification, and that it's all a contingent, it's provisional on the next piece of information to come along. So for science to work, it has to be open-minded. It can't be dogmatic. And if you're too dogmatic, well, guess what? You're going to get really embarrassed when someone comes along and says, well, you know what? Actually, the continents do move. The continental drift is true. Because, plate tectonics didn't exist 100 years ago. It was only in the early 1900s that Alfred Wegener said, hey, I think the continents drift. And everyone said, you're crazy. And only in the 1960s did the theory of plate tectonics develop and show a mechanism whereby continents could move around. And if you're a scientist and you get too locked into one theory, you're going to get in trouble.
Since, Joel, you write about science and also about politics, I wonder if you think there is anything that can be done to strip the instant political implications of the embrace or rejection of certain kinds of science in the modern world.
Well, everything's embedded in the political world. We wouldn't be talking about these issues if they didn't have policy implications or implications in terms of how we behave. So with vaccines, for example, that's a big issue if you have a child. I mean, you can take a child to the doctor and have the doctor inject something in that child. That's I don't know if that's political, but it's a big deal. And, of course, the evidence is that it's safe. But a lot of these issues, you look at the GMO issue. So the scientific consensus is pretty solid that there is nothing unsafe about consuming genetically modified foods. On certain issues, like what's the environmental impact of them, the consensus might weaken a little bit. There may be some arguments that, well, you have to be careful how you use this stuff. And then there's economic arguments against GMOs, with people don't liking – some people don't like the fact that large corporations like Monsanto wind up owning the technology. They own the seeds. And there are some ideological and political objections to that. So some of these issues, that you kind of have to sift through them and figure out, well, what exactly are people worried about? What are they objecting to? And the GMO debate is one that has different layers. But we're all political people, and we're embedded in a political culture on evolution. Should children be taught creationism alongside evolution in public schools? Scientists will tell you no, because it's not a scientific theory. But obviously that's a fraught issue in some communities.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Linda on the line in Dallas. Hi, Linda.
Hi. I'm really enjoying this discussion, and it's one I've thought about and probably lived most of my life. I was part of the early movement when childbirth was very different than it is now, and got to watch that change, and it was largely because of the dialogue of people who argued with scientists. And the reason I wanted to make a comment was your show began with the idea that why are so many reasonable people seemingly not looking at true science? And I just wanted you to encourage you to maybe preface these kind of programs a little differently, because there are a lot of us that may not agree with scientists, but we are very interested in being part of the dialogue. And I think it does put some people off a little bit to be characterized that way.
Well, I appreciate the point you made, Linda. Thank you. Do you want to respond to that at all, Joel?
Yeah, I think Linda's made a really good point, which is that I think labeling people anti-science is a mistake. That, first of all, beyond the fact that sometimes people who are, quote, you know, skeptical of the scientific consensus, they do turn out to be right sometimes. But also, I think that all of us in general understand that on a contentious issue, you have to appeal to evidence, not just belief, that you have to prove your case, that the empirical data are decisive, that's how you decide what's true or not. It's not a matter of, well, this is what I want to be true, or this is what my parents taught me was true, or this is what is I have to believe in order to be a member of the club. I think that we all know now that in order to engage in these arguments or these issues, that that you have to look at the data and the facts. So what happens is people tend to have their own set of facts, their own. So people are not anti-science, but they tend to have their own version of the science. They think they have better science, and so I think if you, Linda, if you read the article in National Geographic, I don't know if you have a chance to read it yet. I hope you see that it doesn't ridicule people, doesn't try to elevate, you know, me above other folks or elevate scientists above other folks. And so check it out and let me know what you think.
How is reporting on scientific issues different from reporting on other things in terms of the responsibility, for example, to present alternative views and how you do that responsibly when you're talking about science?
Well, I would say that you don't want to make the mistake of false balance and on an issue say, well, one side says that humans are contributing to climate change and the other side says they're not, because the overwhelming evidence is that humans are contributing to climate change. So you don't want to have a false balance. You know, with science, I mean, the reason I like being a science reporter is that I don't actually know any of this stuff. I'm not a scientist. I love to figure, you know, find out about it and talk to the people who are scientists. And I say to them, I often say, well, I don't understand. Tell me again. And I press them to explain it in a way that I can understand. And then I my job is to write it in a way that my readers can understand. And you know, I'm not the expert. I'm just the medium. I do think that we live in an amazing time, and we live in this accelerating Anthropocene moment where suddenly human beings are changing the planet in a dramatic way, and I've seen it in my own lifetime. I'm 54 years old, look much younger, of course, but I've seen it in my own lifetime. And so what's going on here? Is this good? Is this bad? Is this how are we gonna make a beautiful world at the end of this incredible efflorescence of science and technology? I want to know. And so being a science reporter, I do cover politics sometimes and chase after candidates and all that sort of stuff. But I'm an explanatory writer, and to be a good explanatory writer, you have to first of all be humble about what you do and do not understand and do not know. So that's why I often say to my sources, "Tell me again, because I don't understand yet. Make it simpler. Tell me again." And often they like being asked the really simple questions of what does this mean? How do you know this? Do you have any doubts? How did you figure this out? So a good science story doesn't just tell you the end result. It says, how did they figure this out? What's their procedure? What's the mechanism for understanding it?
Is there a good way for us to read science stories and keep that in the back of our minds beyond simply what you just said? I mean, understanding how it was done. And then, I mean, should we read every science story with the realization that something else may come along in a year or 10 years or 20 years that will really change what is believed to be factual about today's evidence?
Yes and no. So, no, you shouldn't assume that that the consensus on one of these issues is suddenly going to be overturned by the latest study. There's a tendency for those of us in the media to overemphasize the latest study and sometimes hype its dramatic impact and sort of say, you know, this changes everything. A scientist had a eureka moment and has somehow single-handedly overturned centuries of orthodoxy. We love stories like that. It doesn't really happen very often. I mean, by and large, science is extremely incremental and collaborative, and it's less like a house of cards than it's like a big pyramid, big stone pyramid. And, you sometimes have paradigm shifts and, you know, massive upheavals like you had in geology with plate tectonics. But by and large... people should understand that the latest story coming out of the lab is not the final word, okay? And that everything is provisional, and look widely for lots of different sources of information and keep an open mind.
Joel Achenbach writes for The Washington Post. His article, "The Age of Disbelief, Why Do So Many Reasonable People Doubt Science?" is the cover story of the March National Geographic. Joel, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker, engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.